We'll resume our tribute to the late Wayne Green in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. From the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR, with part two of our tribute to the late ham radio icon, Wayne Green, W2NSD. In the fall of 2003, Wayne announced he was pulling the literary plug on 73 Magazine, a publication he credited with a number of accomplishments over the decades he published it. Here's the first excerpt from an interview Rains Hap Holly, KC9RP, conducted with Wayne in late 2003 following the demise of 73.
Wayne, what happened?
Basically, amateur radio as a hobby is gradually grinding down, and it's been more and more difficult to put out the magazine. The book sales have kept 73 going for the last few years. And then I have not been invited on the Coast to Coast program very often since Art Bell retired. Before that, I'd been on 22 times. And each time I'd get on, I'd get like 10,000 letters from listeners asking for my catalog, and I'd sell a whole slew of books. I haven't been on almost a year now, so the book sales have dwindled way, way down. And it made it so that there was no way to really keep 73 going. The ad sales are down, and the receipts from ad sales are down even worse than the ads. And I could see that, there's probably other things that I could do that would be more important as far as the world is concerned. Let me give just a short history of this whole thing to put it into perspective. An angel appeared one day when Alfie, my best friend, and I were in church going to Sunday school, and this angel came in with a box of old radio parts and gave them to Alfie. And Alfie looked at them and said, "Yeah, do you want them?" And I said, "Of course." So I took them home and found an article in Popular Mechanics on a radio that used a lot of the parts. So I built it, and it worked, the cigar box radio. And that got me started building. And, of course, friends all donated their old radios out of the attic, and soon I was up to here taking old radios apart. I sure wish I hadn't taken them all apart now. They're pretty valuable, I think, as antiques. I had a lot of fun building, joined the radio club in school when I went to high school. They helped teach me the code and everything for the license and so forth, and eventually got licensed as W2NSD, Never Say Die. We're talking about 1940. I was graduating from high school, and they said, "Well, you know, you got a ham license and everything. You should go to an engineering school. And beside, you know, we've done all these tests, and you have one of the highest mechanical aptitudes we've ever measured, and you really must become an electrical engineer." So instead of going to Dartmouth, as I thought I would, not really having any idea what to do in the future, I went to RPI, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute up in Troy, New York, set up a course with my ham radio in my dorm, and had a ball with that, and then got pledged to a fraternity and had my ham set up there. And along came World War II. The selected service people said, "Well, we don't think people should be going to college. They should be in the Army fighting." And I didn't like the sound of that much, so I kind of looked around for what to do. And a friend of my father's got me in touch with the head of the Naval Research Laboratory in Anacostia, Virginia. And I went down and interviewed there, and he said, "Yes, I'd love to have you working here in the lab. But first you have to go to radar school," and that made sense. So I joined the Navy and spent the next 9 months going through electronic school, a superb school, absolutely superb. At the end of that, I was supposed to get in touch with Commander Bourne at Anacostia, and I said, "Well, you know, heck, I'm single, and a job like that should be for married people that have a family." I decided I don't like people giving me orders and telling me what to do. So it's either a destroyer or a submarine would be my best bet. And submarines paid more, so I volunteered for submarine duty. And I spent the rest of the war on a submarine as an electronic technician and wrote a book about it called Submarines in World War II, which is available. And I had some very interesting and exciting adventures in a submarine. We were one of the top scoring submarines. At any rate, after the war, back to college, somehow I've always been interested in new technologies. When I first got my license, I had built a 2.5-meter transceiver, a little walkie-talkie, and made my first contacts with that. Then after the war, NBFM, narrowband FM, came along with Jack Badkus, W2GDG, who discovered that or developed it, went on later to found Sonar Radio, and I was one of the first ones on with that and had a wonderful time. Then I discovered RTTY. I couldn't get John Williams, W2BFD, the fellow who was really promoting that, to do a newsletter. So I said, what the heck? And I started a newsletter, which became a magazine pretty quick, called Amateur Radio Frontiers. And I had a wonderful time with that. And pretty soon I had a column in CQ on RTTY. And then I got the editor of CQ a better job. The next thing I knew, I was the editor of CQ, 1955. And I was the editor there for 5 years to the day. And the last year, they owed me a year's back pay because they're busy paying for the publisher's yacht. Then they fired me so they wouldn't have to pay me, and they never did. It was in my blood by then. I loved publishing a ham radio magazine. So I sold all the toys that I had, like a yacht, a little speedboat, an airplane, stuff like that, and got enough money just to publish the first issue of 73 magazine, and that was 1960. It took hold and did well, and by 1963, we had 850 ham radio stores around the country carrying 73 on their counter. The magazine was growing well. I moved up to New Hampshire in 1962, get out of Brooklyn, New York, moved into a great big 40-room house up in New Hampshire, and published the magazine out of there. And then came disaster. Then came incentive licensing, which the ARRL proposed to, and the FCC put through as a proposal, which would take away all of the HF phone bands from the general class amateurs. They'd have to get out and get their advanced class license or their extra class license. What it did was take us back to pre-war days of Class A and Class B, where the Class A had 75 and 20, and Class B had 160 and 10. And they also were taking away 15 meters and 40 meters from the general class. That's what was proposed. They also proposed that new licensees would have to wait 2 years before they could upgrade. The result of this was that it took the FCC 5 years to finally do something about this, and what they did was take away half of the phone bands, not all of them. But the ARRL convinced everybody that the FCC was going to do what they requested, and so the result was that tens of thousands of hams said, oh, I can't go down and do that license exam again. I've forgotten everything that I learned the first time. I'm just not going to do it. So they sold their equipment for pennies on the dollar. This put roughly a little over 700 of the radio stores out of business in the next 2 years. It put all of the major manufacturers out of business. Hallicrafters, Hammerland, National Radio Company, Multi-Elmac, Gonset eventually went out of business, and Swan, and so forth. Some of them hung on a little bit, but not long. Even Collins gave up amateur radio manufacturing because nobody was buying new equipment when you could buy perfectly good old sets for $100. Eventually, when FM and repeaters came in 1970, a few years later, were replaced by Japanese companies, making about 90% of the ham radio sales these days.
You're listening to our tribute to the late ham radio pioneer, the controversial Wayne Green, W2NSD. Hap Holly will conclude this excerpt from his interview with Wayne in a moment. This is the Rain Report, available for transmission over amateur radio under a Creative Commons license. See therainreport.com for details.
You are listening to The Rain Report from www.therainreport.com.
At any rate, with 73 magazine, I promoted 2 meter FM and repeaters. And I said, I think I can make this so that we'll get this hobby growing again. We had about 100 repeaters in 1968. I published hundreds of articles on it, then published a repeater journal and published books on the subject and the repeater atlas and so forth and so on. The result was that it became the biggest activity in amateur radio, not only in the United States, but all around the world. We ended up with something over 8,000 repeaters. I held meetings around the country to organize the frequencies so that we'd have standardized channels all over the country. And I held a meeting with the FCC commissioners to change the rules. They had put through some terrible rules under their Prose Walker's direction. And it was almost as hard to get a repeater license as it was a commercial radio license. So I took a group of repeater people down to Washington. We held a meeting and had the biggest change in amateur radio regulations in the history of the hobby. And all of a sudden, repeaters were blossoming everywhere by the thousands. And, of course, I wrote a lot of editorials at the time saying, hey, I'm able to ski in New Hampshire and out in Aspen with a little handy talking and make phone calls through the repeater anywhere in the world. Everybody's going to want to do this. And, of course, the hams in Chicago went to the Motorola people and said, hey, here's a good possibility. And the next thing you know, we had cell phones, and there are now 2 billion users of cell phones around the world. I think more than any other publication, we helped make that happen. When I started 73, I did it mainly with construction articles because I had made CQ grow tremendously by publishing lots and lots of construction articles. And when they fired me, they took over and said, well, we don't want to bother with that. We'll just run columns. So they pretty much stopped running construction articles. So I started 73, and that was just packed with construction articles. And I even put together kits to make it easy for people, getting them out there pretty much at cost by the hundreds. And we pioneered sideband. When transistors came along, I said, uh-oh, I held an auction of all my ham radio gear, which was all tube stuff, and I gave away tubes for pennies and cleaned out my barn, which was packed with parts from years and years of building. Had to start over again once the transistors were here. In 1975, the first personal computer came on the market as a kit from Albuquerque, New Mexico, a little outfit down there. I got one of those. They were advertising in my magazine selling a little 4-bit calculator, and they were getting $129 for them. And, of course, pretty soon Casio came out with one for about $19 and put them out of business. So they had to quick find something else to do, and Ed Roberts, the head of the company, was a computer hobbyist, so he put this kit on the market, and I got one and put it together, and I said, hey, this is going to be great. This is going to be good. This is going to be a new industry. I quick called the editors of Computer Club newsletters and said, I want to start a magazine and really help this industry to grow and become something. And I finally found one that agreed with me that it was possible to do that, and I brought him to New Hampshire, and we put out the first issue of Byte, B-Y-T-E, Byte magazine. The first issue went to press 5 weeks after I started the project, and the crew of 73 did all of the production work on it, and the ad sales, and the circulation sales, and so forth, and handled everything. Byte went on to become the largest magazine in the country. Then I started Microcomputing Magazine, and then 80 Micro for the TRS-80, the first specific computer magazine, and that became the third largest magazine in the country, running over 600 pages a month, and 13 issues a year. With all these magazines, I had Insider for the Apple and Run for the Commodore and Hot Cocoa for the Color Computer, and I had a magazine for the computer stores and so forth and so on. This attracted the attention of the bigger companies. The mega publishers, the billion-dollar companies, came in and said, well, look, we'll give you a choice. Either you sell your magazines to us, or we'll put you out of business. Which would you prefer? Not being too dumb about that, I picked out the one that looked like the best bet and sold all my magazines to them, and I no longer had a publishing company. because I had to sell the whole works, buildings and everything. So I had to sell 73 along with that because I had no further way to publish it. At that time, we had about 120,000 readers, and that was 1983. And then 3 years later, I got a call saying that they would pay me $250,000 to take it back. So I said, okay. By then, I had a new publishing company. I was publishing CD Review magazine, which got to be the largest music magazine in the country. And I was producing CDs, and I had a recording studio, having a lot of fun with that, and helped make that the fastest growing consumer electronic industry in history. So I took 73 back. When I got it back 3 years later, it had about 30,000 readers, a little less than that. And advertising was way down, and it never recovered, because by then the steam had gone out of amateur radio. We had no new technologies to get people excited, and the code was stopping new people from coming in. Even more was the total lack of any advertising or promotion of the hobby, so people didn't know about it. My gosh, when I got my license, the local paper, the Brooklyn Daily Eagle, ran an article about it because the ARL sent them the information. And then when I worked all states, again, there was an article about that because the ARL sent them the PR. And when I worked all continents, and then when I won contests, everything that I did, ARL sent promotions out. And they haven't done that in years, so today the hobby is almost unknown with kids. When I give talks to colleges and universities on the subject of entrepreneurialism, I have a PhD in that subject, I always ask the kids, how many of you are familiar with amateur radio? And two or three hands will go up and they'll say, well, it's something like CD, isn't it? And that's all they know. It's no wonder that we have so few kids coming into the hobby and that the average age of amateurs is going up toward the average death age of the population.
If you rub your crystal ball, and I know you have a big crystal ball there.
I don't know. What frequency is a crystal?
I don't know. I don't know.
7220, right?
That's probably close to it. Where are we going with amateur radio? What part of our spectrum will we be able to hang on to in the long run?
Well, I think the only thing that won't have a lot of pressure is our HF bands. The microwaves are going to go because we have so many new services coming along that require frequencies up there. But we don't have much coming along that requires things on 20 meters. I haven't kept track of what's doing with international broadcasting, but I don't think that's a growing interest around the world, a big one anyway. And we don't need HF for most things when you've got satellites up there. I think it's going to be the microwaves that we will lose. And we're not using them. We deserve to lose them. If you remember what the FCC regulations said, that this is a service. And in return for our use of these frequencies, we are supposed to provide a group of trained electronic technicians and operators for time of war. Well, they have no interest in us for time of war anymore. No interest whatever. Because they don't need technicians anymore. As far as I know, they've closed down the electronic schools. All you have to do is replace a module today, and the light turns up and tells you what module to replace. We don't have to fix things anymore. What are we doing? Occasionally, we can step in and help with emergencies, but cell phones pretty much are taking care of that for most of them, and it's only when the cell phones go out or get totally overloaded that amateurs can step in and help out. So where's it going? You tell me.
I've been speaking with Wayne Green, W2NSD, the founder, editor, and publisher of 73 Magazine for all but 3 years, from 1960 until its demise and final issue in September of 2003.
43 years, pretty good run.
Indeed. For the Rain Report, I'm Hap Holly, KC9RP in Chicago.
The Rain Report is copyright 1990 through 2013 Rain, all rights reserved. Now, for everyone affiliated with the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR, bidding you very 73 from The Rain Report. www.therainreport.com.